Speaking with Professor Sean McMeekin of Bard College, the author of the new book, Stalin's War, A New History of World War II, from the point of view of Joseph Stalin, who inherits from Vladimir Lenin the thinking, the theory, set the imperialist capitalist states against each other, do not enter the war until the end and gobble up territory, recover the Russian Empire and more, create the power of the earth by watching the monster nations of France and Germany, those in England, those were the three that Stalin had in mind, batter each other just as they did in the Great War. The U.S., of course, was a new consideration for Stalin. And now comes a mystery that Sean presents to us in his book. I said the Battle of Moscow turns on a couple of details, the frozen ground followed by the muddy ground, the exhausted German invasion, the exhausted Russian defenders. However, 6 months earlier, a man named Harry Hopkins, representing the President of the United States, lands in what Sean gives us the detail, an American Douglas transport craft. After a four-hour flight, he lands at Moscow. Sean, what is the mission to Moscow for Harry Hopkins? Who is he, and what does he accomplish?
Well, I think the purpose of Hopkins' trip to Moscow was to establish a very direct channel of communication between Roosevelt and Stalin, to some extent, to try to find out what the odds of survival were, except that Hopkins, I think, was already convinced that Russia would survive. In fact, he already saw the U.S. military attaché, Colonel Ivan Yeaton, as kind of an enemy because Yeaton had some doubts about Russia's warfighting capacity. The main purpose is just to arm Stalin, to arm the Russians, ostensibly in order to, of course, counterbalance Hitler's armies and in the long run make it so that the United States would presumably have an easier time of it if and when the U.S. entered the war. The U.S. at the time, of course, was still neutral. But effectively, he establishes this very personal relationship with Stalin, at one point even meeting him without interpreters or even any aides present. And to Stalin's surprise, really, and almost to his shock, he just basically says, we're going to give you whatever you want with no conditions applied. You know, Yeaton, who wanted to apply certain conditions regarding his terms of access to information and maybe even observe how the stuff might be used at the front. This is all denied. Yeaton is sacked. Hopkins actually appoints a man to replace him, Colonel Raymond Faymanville, who actually is an NKVD asset and regularly meets with the Soviet secret police. And Stalin basically says what he needs. I mean, there are all kinds of things that he needs. Aluminum is actually probably number one on that list, although anti-aircraft guns and artillery and small arms ammunition. There are a lot of other things that he needs as well. In the end, they need just about everything. I mean, foodstuffs, boots for uniforms. They need Jeeps, Studebakers. Not all of it is determined in this July meeting, but the basic of the relationship is already established, which is a very one-side thing. The U.S. will give Stalin whatever he wants and demand nothing in return. Among other things that I think we were just talking about with Japan, he does not ask the Soviets for any help against Japan in exchange for almost single-handedly fueling and funding and arming a vast percentage of Stalin's ability to fight for war over the next 4 years.
The politics of this. FDR, as Sean has indicated, was disposed towards aiding Stalin's fight against Hitler. However, there are voices, very powerful voices in the Congress in the United States, who believe that in any attempt to aid Stalin is the same as aiding the devil. We come to a quote from the very powerful Hiram Johnson of California. Scoundrels, Hitler and Stalin, he goes on to say. Hamilton Fish of New York says that no American mother should have to suffer aiding Stalin or in any fashion supporting Stalin. Harry Truman himself says, well, we'll back the one that seems to be winning, Hitler or Stalin. In other words, they're regarded as the same kind of beasts. And the quote from La Follette, FDR is trying to whitewash the monsters in Moscow. These are atheists from the point of view of the United States in 1941. They do not have all the facts of what Stalin's NKVD has done in the Baltic states or in Poland or in Finland, but they're correct in assuming it was monstrous. We know Sean lays out the facts. They're too gory to reproduce of what Stalin's been up to. He is a monster. To debate Hitler or Stalin, who is worse, is foolish. The opinion is both of them to be gone. Sean, the mystery is, What is FDR's opinion that he overcomes these sensible voices in his own party?
Well, just a brief correction. Truman actually said we should aid whichever side was losing or weaker, not the side that was winning.
All right, fine.
I think the idea was, effectively to help them fight it out. But yeah, why did Roosevelt view things so differently? This is a little bit of a mystery. I mean, there's probably this angle of kind of noblesse oblige, almost seeing the Soviets as this plucky underdog. It was something of a fashionable opinion, particularly among many of America's kind of, you might say, well-born and well-connected. Not that they were all Soviet sympathizers, but you got more of that than you did in, say, the Midwest, or in a lot of the rural areas of the country where people were, I think, equally wary of both dictators or seeing them as equally as evil as guilty. Roosevelt sides very, very firmly with Stalin. I mean, there's nothing ambiguous about this at all. Back in March, when they were debating the Lend-Lease Act, there had actually been a congressman from Massachusetts, Tinkham, and also a senator, Reynolds, from North Carolina, I believe, who proposed amendments to try to exclude the Soviet Union from Lend-Lease aid. Those were defeated, mostly because the Democrats controlled Congress, so even if some of them, they had such a firm majority, even if some Democrats voted against, they still had enough votes to defeat the amendments. And so Roosevelt had effectively already won the political battle. They had determined effectively it was all up to his discretion, this kind of good faith clause. He could make the determination himself. But he was, of course, no political naive, so he knew he could just announce it out loud. And so, in fact, they keep this basically secret for the first 6 months. They even conduct their own opinion polls. So Hopkins has the Gallup poll. They did a public one where 54% of the U.S. public was opposed to aiding the Soviet Union against Hitler. Their own polls show that they have majority support in only 11 out of the 48 states, not including any of the key ones involved in Lend-Lease production or shipment, not Michigan, not California, not New York. There's no clear majority. So they know that they have to keep this secret, and that's why they do, really, until November. I suppose the drama of the kind of the revolution parade and Stalin staying in Moscow and making it seem like the Soviets probably would survive. This is what leads, I think, Roosevelt to kind of come out in the open and admit what he's been doing all along with a $1 billion credit line, doubled to $2 billion. And, you know, by the end of the war, it's more than $11 billion. Effectively, no questions asked, no terms applied, no quid pro quos demanded. But it's definitely a controversial policy, which is why they kept it so hidden from the public for so long.
The puzzle, in addition, includes Churchill. Churchill is not fooled by Stalin's conduct. He's not a politician who spends a lot of time being consistent. He'll change if he must. And he finds a way to present Stalin to the British public as acceptable. However, he also participates in Lend-Lease by letting equipment that he needs, either in Singapore or at home, he lets that equipment go on to Stalin. One interpretation, the one I like, although it's so cynical, is that they were hiring the Russian army as cannon fodder. Does that hold up to the fact, Sean?
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, Churchill had at times almost an excess of imagination. That is to say, he was so imaginative that he would have these almost kind of flights of inspiration or fancy. So that after Barbarossa, after the Germans invade the Soviet Union, you know, he says, look, I know that the Soviets have committed all these crimes, but I'm just going to forget about it because I'm so overwhelmed with sympathy. And among other things, as you point out, this famous shipment of the 200 Hawker Hurricane fighters, the workhorse of the RAF during the Battle of Britain, that are supposed to defend Singapore, and instead he sends them to Stalin, along with hundreds more warplanes that fall, and the Matilda and the Valentine tanks, and aluminum, which actually retards Britain's own aircraft industry. I mean, Britain is actually forced really to kind of hold things in for a couple of years as far as her own commitments, even her own domestic manufacturing, because so much is reconsigned or sent to Stalin. And yes, I mean, even some of the equipment which was supposed to defend Egypt, we're talking about kind of the battle in North Africa. A lot of those tanks are actually sent to Stalin instead by way of Iran. Now, as far as the purpose of this, again, I think some of this is, as Churchill had already made clear, that he saw the Soviets as a bulwark against Hitler, even when they were partnered with Hitler. He had talked about this as early as 1939 and 1940. He was actually somewhat notorious for this. So he definitely had this idea. I think some of it was also his historical imagination. He remembered that Russia was on Britain's side in the First World War. So he still had this notion of the brotherhood in arms, no matter how obnoxious Stalin might have been in his regime, no matter how many crimes they might have committed, there was still this notion that there was a kind of a natural relationship, brotherhood in arms, or as you put it more cynically or hard-nosedly, perhaps he simply saw the Russians as kind of cannon fodder. And there's an argument that has been made, is that this basically allows Britain to avoid really fighting the Germans directly for, you know, most of the period between 1940 and 1944, except for in North Africa and over the skies and eventually in Italy beginning in July 1943. It's true. The Russians were doing most of the fighting. And that gave them almost this kind of moral blackmail argument. You know, the Americans are sending us spam, but we're the ones bleeding and suffering and dying. And you'll hear Russians say this today. So the Russians definitely support that interpretation of Lend-Lease.
The book is Stalin's War. Sean McMeekin is the author, A New History of World War II. Sean mentions North Africa. We'll go there for the Darlan deal. The Darlan deal becomes a problem for FDR, and the solution is unconditional surrender. I'm John Basham.